impedance complex number, which we'll get into next time, but he's just using it as an example. The sign of the reactance indicates whether it's an inductive, which is positive, or capacitive, which is negative. In this case, it's capacitive, so it's negative. And that's because current leads, and the capacitor current leads the voltage by 90 degrees, and the inductor voltage leads the current by 90 degrees, and that's the way that is. Talk about pure capacitance and pure inductances. As reactance changes with frequency, impedance does too. Okay, so reactance will change with the frequency because it's frequency dependent, and the impedance will change with frequency. That's something also to think about and to consider. Okay, so up to this point, any quick questions? WHCDL.
Oh my God.
All right. Okay, so now we're going to talk about converting impedance. Okay, so when we talk about matching impedance, what we're really talking about is converting impedance from one ratio of voltage and current to a different ratio while losing the least amount of power in the process. And that's also important because you don't want to lose power. Power will be lost as heat, as a typical example, or by other means of attenuation, high resistance, or mismatching, and so on. You don't want to lose power. You want to transfer as much power as you can. Transformers are pretty efficient devices. They will transfer at least 95% or more of their power from their primary to their secondary. I'm talking about iron core transformers, like power transformers. The same is true with RF transformers, and there's many different types of RF transformers, like toroids, for instance, and balance, and unins, those examples. So. And we'll get into that later on. As I said, the discussion can get pretty involved and get pretty deep. So, returning to the mathematical analogy, you use an impedance converter every time you drive your car. The transmission is a set of gears that convert the torque to rotation rate ratio at the engine's output to be a different ratio at the drive shaft. By selecting different gear ratios, the transmission allows your engine to supply power at the optimum torque to rate of rotation. Even though the car speed may be anything from barely moving, requiring a low gear ratio, to speeding ticket worthy at a high gear ratio. You don't want to get a ticket. The only power lost is from the friction of the gears and bearings, so input power is almost the same as output power, just as a dip in impedance. Okay? See, now there's a formula called efficiency. And efficiency happens to be output over input. So if you take it as something that's got a certain output power and you divide it by the input power, you can get the actual efficiency, and it's usually in a percentage, so you multiply by 100, and you could see the percentage of efficiency up to 100%. As I said earlier, transformers, iron core transformers are pretty efficient.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Okay, I got one bagel on that. Let me let it drop again. I just started to say transformers are pretty efficient, and they have efficiencies up to like 98% of efficiency. So they transfer most of their, if not all of their power from the primary to the secondary. And that's because of the design of the transformer itself. Transformers, I'm talking about power transformers, or audio output transformers, they use laminated cores, which reduce what's known as eddy currents, and we can, get into that discussion a little bit, talking about transformers and how they work. there's other losses as well. So, and they're pretty, the way they're designed, they're pretty efficient. Okay, so here's a question. Why match impedances? You could think of an impedance matching circuit as a sort of an electrical gearbox. The combination and connections of components make up the gears that transfer power from input to output. The goal is the same as a mechanical gearbox, maximizing power transfer from the source to the load, or allowing the source to generate power in an optimum combination of voltage and current. And that's exactly what you want. You want to get the maximum power, as I said before. Solid-state transmitters are particularly sensitive to load impedances. And I know that Dick has mentioned that a number of times. There's a thing called a conjugate match, which I know he mentioned, of how they match. And actually, we did a little discussion and experiment at HRU. Roy and I did the, the test equipment seminar? I forgot what it's called. And we showed how a transmitter, if you purposely change the loading on a solid-state transmitter, how much reflected power you're going to get, or how much less power efficiency, and so on. So we did a little thing with that. So as I said, solid-state transmitters are particularly sensitive to load impedance. Impedances from far from the 50-ohm most transmitters expect can raise voltages or currents to the output transistors. Now, I just want to repeat that again because I want to get the wording right. Solid-state transmitters are particularly sensitive to load impedance. Impedances far from the 50-ohm, I don't know why you said it that way. Impedances far from the...
Repeater, timeout.
By the way, those are 3-minute time...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
I got you. I'm probably talking more than 3 minutes. Okay, the wording here is a little bit obscured, so just bear with me because I'm just reading the words. And thanks, Lou. I got to just remember to let it drop. Solid-state transmitters are particularly sensitive to load impedance. Impedance is far from the 50-ohm. It just says far from the 50-ohm. It should say impedances that are not 50 ohms, most transmitters expect can raise voltages or currents in the output transistors. In other words, what they're saying is if you have a mismatch from your transmitter to your load, you're going to have a current increase in your transistors, and that is the reason why these radios that you buy now have shutback or output power protection in different ways, where if you have a mismatch of, let's say, greater than 3-to-1, it's going to reduce the power and protect the final transistors, because your current, your final transistor current will increase. And if you have a power supply with an ammeter on it, you can actually see if your transmitter is working properly by looking at the current draw from the ammeter. And I do that all the time. If I see an ammeter drawing way too much current, I don't continue transmitting. I shut it down. And that could be a function of biasing or other malfunctions of the or misadjustments of the transmitter. All right, let me let it drop. Okay, so they're going to say that next, and I said it ahead of time. Protective circuits reduce drive power to the amplifier stage until voltages and currents are within safe limits. This also reduces the bandwidth which your transmitter will output full rated power. Matching the feed line impedances to the specified 50 ohm keeps your transmitter happy. So basically, he's just saying what I just said. You want to make sure that your transmitter is matched properly. Otherwise, you could have reduced power depending on the the type of radio that you're using, and hopefully it does have a power protection circuit that will not cause any harm to your transmitter if your impedances are mismatch is to a you know, to a higher mismatch than what it's rated for. Okay, let it drop again. Any questions up to this point? Go ahead.
I have a comment.
AY situation.
Okay, I heard Wesley. I think that was Wesley and Lou. Wesley, if that was you, go ahead.
The only addition I have is about your comment about 50 ohm is 50 ohm is just is not the magic number, it's just the chosen number. So we could have any impedance match at any impedance of the source. So ZS equals ZL, ZS equals ZL, where the load impedance is ZL and source impedance is ZS. And that would be complex conjugative variables for the calculation. I've seen 600 ohms, and also the transmitter was 600 ohms instead of 50 ohms, and it was a perfect match with 600 ohm antenna. It was you.
Yeah, I mean, look, you can have any impedance you want, but keep in mind, Wesley, we're using 50 ohms because most hams and most rigs that we buy have a 50 are set up for a 50 ohm system. So I understand what you're saying, but I'm not deviating from 50 ohms, and it's right here in the article that our antennas, our feed lines that we buy, the feed line you're using right now, I'm sure is a 50 ohm line, or pretty close to it. Well, hopefully it would be 50 ohms, unless you're using, maybe using 450 ohm ladder line, and you're rematching it to a 50 ohm antenna. So just keep in mind the 50 ohm number, and let's not deviate too far from that, because you know, I don't want to throw a monkey wrench into other things, because we could talk about audio impedances, and we could talk about impedance mismatch and matching in amplifiers and transistors, and it's a very broad subject, impedance matching. It encompasses a lot of different things, so I just want to keep that in mind. Lou, over to you. You were next. UA2CDL. Are you there, MY2H? I heard you come in.
Late check-in.
Inverted impedances, there was a price to pay, and if I remember, like, something was cut in half. I don't know if it's power or what, and I wasn't quite sure what that was. But then when you presented the analogy of the transmission on the car, you said most, if not all, of the power gets transferred except for the minor gear resistance or what have you. So I'm not sure what, do you recall what you said about any time we match there's a price to pay or something to that effect in the last week or two? Back to you.
Yeah, it has to do with efficiency. And if you do a calculation, you can see that impedances, matched impedance are only 50%. The efficiency is only 50% because you lose half your power in your source and the other half in your load. So impedances are matched. When impedances are matched, the efficiency is only 50%. And we can get into the formula to explain why. Let me just get the other station. There was a late check-in. Roy, you want to pick that up? You want to pick up that late check-in, Roy?
Okay. Who is the gentleman who said late check-in?
Roger. This is KC2QYW, Joe in the mobile.
Okay, Joe, right now we're doing Andy's Corner. If you have any questions, you can kind of hold on to them, and when Andy's Corner is done, I'll continue to take questions, okay?
Roger, Roger.
Okay, back to you, Andy.
Okay, very good. Yeah, so as I just said, maximum power transfer occurs when impedances are matched, and I'm just, you know, I'm not reading this, I'm just saying this. Maximum power transfers when impedances, well, you get maximum power transfer when impedances are matched, but it's only 50% efficient. And if you do a calculation of seeing what the power is across a resistor, because any generator has a resistor, can be considered to have a resistor in series with the generator that's generating the signal, and of course the load is a resistive load, as an example. So if you measure the power across each resistor, the source and the load, you can see that half the power is lost in the source and the other half is lost in the load. Well, not really lost, being consumed by the load. It's not lost. And that's where maximum power is transferred. So, Lou, does that answer your question? That's what we were mentioning last week.
Yeah, I think so. You're saying the internal resistance of the power source, yeah. In other words, we always look at ideal power sources, but in practice they have an internal resistance, and naturally that's going to dissipate. So that's interesting. And then when you're matched, of course, even if it's one-to-one, if you had to do no conversion, same would apply. So it's not so much that your impedance matching that causes that penalty. It's, as you said, whenever anything is matched, whether it's because you had to match it because they were different, or they were the same all along and it didn't require any matching, you'd still have that 50% efficiency.
Was this over your Y2U with a comment, Andy?
Yeah, go ahead. Is this Ed? I forgot your name, sorry.
No, Andy, this is Mike, WY2U. We spoke a while ago. You were having some questions, remember, about the repeater installation on top of the, where was it? Glen Oaks, I guess it was.
Oh, yeah, yeah, Mike. I think we were talking about maybe the antenna or something. I don't quite remember. My memory is not as good as it used to be. But how you doing? And, yeah, you're a good source of information, and we could use you.
Well, thanks for the kind words. Appreciate it. But I do want to clear up something so that people do not get the impression that the maximum efficiency that you could ever get in a transmission system is 50%. That's not true at all. Because when you're doing an impedance matching, per se, of a transmitting circuit, whether it be a tube, a bipolar transistor, or a field effect transistor, the actual model of the source probably represents close to an ideal current source, which has an infinite impedance as it stands. When you want to match the impedance of a transmitter, what that means is you want to present an impedance to that current source that gives that current source, or transmitter, if you will, the ability to produce a certain amount of power and a certain amount of current and a certain amount of voltage, so that you have a certain amount of efficiency. You're not going to get a 50% loss in power. You can design a transmitter in a Class C circuit, for example, to give you 90% efficiency, only because it's an ideal current source. So I don't want you to give the impression that the maximum efficiency that you're going to get when you impedance match something is 50%. That is not true. Back to you, WY2U.
Okay, yeah, that's true. It's it could be a little bit misleading. I think further on in this article, he's going to be talking about what you just mentioned, which I will get to as far as the ideal, the maximum current. So that's a good point. Let me see. Any other questions before I go on? Because it's getting to be almost 9:30, and I got to take care of a few things. I got another page page and a half to do, but maybe I'll hold off for next week on that because I'm only halfway. I'm not even halfway done with this with what I'm mentioning so far. Any other questions?
Petrucci. KWC.
Okay, I got the N2SJN. I got Ken, KWC. Yeah, Wes, back to you. Go ahead.
What is the difference between resonance at given frequency or impedance matching at given frequency?
I didn't get the question. You said it so fast. What's the difference between what?
What's the difference between impedance matching at given frequency and resonance in given frequency?
Well, the way I see it, resonance is resonant. When you have a resonant circuit, if it's a series circuit, then your reactances cancel, and you at the resonant frequency, and all you're left with is pure resistance. But that has nothing to do with impedance matching. That's just resonance, whether it be parallel or series or a combination of both. So that's the answer to that. One has really nothing to do with the other. One is just resonant, and the other one is matching. Ken, you had a question also. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Andy. This was about, I guess, impedance matching. I have read a number of discussions, and some of them almost reach a religious fervor about the advisability or futility of using an antenna tuner to match impedance. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that.
All right, you know what? I'm going to hold off on the answer because basically I'm giving an overall view of impedance matching. And in another article, which I'm saving for next time or maybe the time after, depending on how much I get done, it's going to discuss transmission lines, impedance matching, and antenna tuners, and any other RF devices or RF means of matching impedances. So if it's okay, if you don't mind, I'm going to hold off on that and not get into antenna tuners just yet until I get through this part, because I just want to get the overview across of what this article is talking about. Okay, back to you.
Okay, no problem. I will stay tuned. WA2CDL, WB2KWC.
AC2GS?
Yes, Roy.
Yeah, I was looking into this subject about the difference between maximum power and maximum efficiency, and it's kind of a curious description. If you can adjust the impedance of both the source and the load, if you somehow got the source impedance down to zero and the load impedance up to infinity, you would have close to 100% efficiency, but next to no power output. So that's how confusing mixing power and efficiency is in electrical circuits.
WA2VDH with a comment.
Okay, very good. Yeah, thanks, Roy. Yeah, it is. It's a little bit confusing. Mike brought up a good point with that. I have read articles where doing the calculation, you can actually figure out that from impedance matching will give you a certain amount of efficiency from the source to the load. We'll have to go into that a little bit further. I do want to get to this next page. I know I'm asking 30 questions, but it gets complicated, and we'll get into a deeper subject. This impedance matching topic can last a few weeks because there's a lot of different ways to do it, and we could talk about that. So it'll be a whole nice discussion over time. Just to mention that. VDH, I forgot your name. Sorry. Over to you.
Yeah, fine business. Name is John. Name is John. Just wanted to give a quick example of that 50% efficiency. What the gentleman said before about the transmitter is true. Yeah, it's like a current source at the output, so that case doesn't apply. But a nice simple case, just take a 20-volt generator whose internal resistance is 50 ohms, and now put a 50-ohm load on that. When you do that, 10 volts appears across the load. The other 10 volts drops across the internal 50-ohm resistance. So the load gets 2 watts, but the generator is putting out 4 watts. So there's the 50% efficiency. Go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. That's the examples that I've seen. So, yes. In dealing with solid-state devices, transmitters, Dick has mentioned different matches as a conjugate match, and actually, most people don't think, and I'm going to just say it this way, that, you know, if you do an SWR check of your transmitter itself, in other words, if you put a, if you feed power back into your radio from an external source through an SWR meter, and you're looking at the output going directly into the output of the power amplifier, and to see actually what is the output VSWR of your transmitter, the transmitter itself. I'm not talking about the feed line or the antenna. When dealing with preamps that are used, when I worked at AIL, and that's where Dick worked, I did testing, and this is back in the 80s. I did testing on amplifiers that were used as a B-1 bomber, and one of the tests we did was input VSWR and output VSWR. We wanted to check it both input and output of the preamp to make sure that the SWR met the specifications required. So any source has an internal impedance, and that's what this is. Why I'm mentioning that. So your transmitter is your nominal impedance of your transmitter should be 50 ohms if most transmitters are. Your feed line should be 50 ohms. Your antenna should be 50 ohms. So everything should be pretty well matched. Okay, let me just ask any more questions, because I want to get into transformers and of matching impedances using transformers. Okay, very good. WA2CDL. Hopefully I won't time it out. So, let's see, it's 9:35. As I say, this will be a good discussion, and we can continue this. So here's transformers with cores. Any method of changing the combination of V, which is voltage, and I, which is current, converts one value of impedance to another. Not all methods are suitable in all uses, of course. The following sections will describe common methods and what they are best for, and where they're used, the best place to use them. So we have resistive matching, and it goes into length, and I want to discuss the transformers with cores, which is an iron core transformer to use. That they use for matching impedances. There's resistive matching, there's reactive matching, there's L networks, there's pi networks, and there's T networks. Each one is a place for a good discussion, and it's quite lengthy. And then there are other matching, other impedance matching techniques. So at this point, there's a lot to absorb. And I just want to convey the information of impedance matching, and that's why I started this article. But I think maybe I'll stop here, because to getting into transformers with cores, you know, iron core transformers, it's a little bit lengthy, and I have to keep stopping to explain it. And then we'll do the resistive matching and then the reactive matching. So maybe at this point, as I said, it's an overview of impedance matching and we have to just start it somewhere, so this is where we start. So, Roy, what do you think? It's going to take a little bit of time to discuss each batching technique and devices and components used. Let me give it to Roy, see what he says. AC2GS, WHCDO.
It's up to you, Andy. You can do the very beginning and leave the rest until next week. Or if you want to, you could leave the remainder of the topic until next week. I leave it totally up to you. We have 45 minutes of time before the space report. I have nothing special to talk about. So, you know, it depends on how you want to organize it.
And what's the question to you?
Okay, I'll talk about transformers, iron core transformers. Again, I'll just discuss that as the first discussion. Wesley, you had a question.
Yeah, my question is, when you're going to be talking about the transformers, are you going to be talking about BH curves, hysteresis, eddy current, and the self-resonance frequency of the transformer?
Well, I could get into BH curves, which is an interesting topic itself. But again, you know, I don't want to go too deep right now because it's not the time for it. You know, there's a lot of math involved if you want to get into that. So I know you have a question in regarding how deep I'm going to get in, but I just want to get this article across, and then we can expand on that. And sure, we could eventually talk about that too. So, all right. So let's continue. And Roy, thanks. I just didn't know what you had scheduled after me. So we're going to talk about transformers, and the way he wrote it, it says transformers with cores, meaning an iron core or some magnetic a component that uses flux and magnetics to transform energy, basically saying it that way. All right, so let it drop first. Okay. The word transformer is a bit overused, so we have to be careful about what type. Transformers in this section have primary, which is the input side, and secondary, which is the output side, windings. Transformers work backwards also, which is interesting if you've never done it, and I have. So transformers work backwards too. So the designation of the windings as input or output applies mostly to voltage and current ratings. Because they use a magnetic field to transfer energy, these are flux-coupled transformers. Power is transferred through the core of the transformer as magnetic energy. See, now that's another discussion. You want to talk about magnetics. So they have in parentheses, transmission line transformers use feed lines wound on a core, but the energy is not transferred through the core. See, now that'll be the further discussion. Cores can be magnetic. Ferrite, you can have a ferrite core, you can have a powdered iron core, or non-magnetic, which is an air core, depending on how the transformer will be used. So, you know, you have air core transformers, and you have powdered iron, and you have ferrite, and those are common substances that they use in cores of transformers, particularly toroids, because toroids can come in powdered iron, or a toroid can come in a ferrite core, and there's a word that I've used before. It's called saturation, and that is, you know, increasing the electrical voltage and current causes magnetic lines of force, and it only goes up to a certain amount, and it's not linear. It's it's not a linear scale, and you reach a point where you can increase your voltage, and you're not going to have any more increase in magnetic flux, and it's something to that effect, and it's called saturation, where it's saturated. Now, saturation also has an inverse property. It produces harmonics. Whenever you saturate something, you create harmonics all over the place, and that has to be considered, because you don't want to radiate, especially with RF, you don't want to radiate harmonics all over the place that are out of band. So you got to be sure that your cores are not saturated.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Okay, I missed the timeout on that one. And by the way, I was not reading that I just read from my own experience. I worked in a company that actually used saturation to produce harmonics purposely, and it was an interesting, very clever concept to determine a particular device that was in proximity of one other device. So you had a proximity circuit, or proximity apparatus is a better word, which determined if this device was within the field of another device because it produced a harmonic in a saturated high magnetic field, and a receiver was then tuned to one of the harmonics. You can actually take a receiver and tune it to one of the harmonics. In this case, it was tuned to the sixth harmonic. And there was a reason for that, because of the Earth's magnetic field affecting it. And that was a pretty clever design, which I worked on. Okay, so to continue, what did I say? Cores can be magnetic, which is ferrite, powdered iron, or non-magnetic air, depending on how the transformer will be used. Alright, flux-coupled transformers are very much like two gears transferring power from one shaft to another. The ratio of gear speeds, which is the current, and the ratio of input and output torque, which is the voltage, are controlled by the ratio of teeth on the gears, which is secondary to primary turns ratio. That's a mouthful, I just said. Basically, the turns ratio of the transformer will determine, you know, how much voltage and how much current you're going to get out of the transformer, basically what it's saying. So the basic voltage and current relationships in a flux-coupled transformer are shown in Figure 1, and there is a figure here, but I can't show it to you. A little bit of math in this paragraph. Assuming power is being transferred from the primary, which is the input circuit, to the secondary, which is the output circuit, the impedance present to whatever is connected to the input winding, which is, you know, the impedance of the primary equals the voltage of the primary divided by the current of the primary. So basically, you know, Z equals...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Okay, W-H-C-D-L back. Probably 3 minutes. So the input winding Z primary is equal to the voltage primary divided by the current primary. Z equals V over I. So the output winding acts like an impedance of Z secondary equals, again, V secondary divided by I secondary. So Z equals V over I in the secondary. From the voltage and current relationships, back to Figure 1, we also know that Z secondary divided by Z primary is the number of turns squared. See, now you're getting into a square because of the properties of the magnetic field. So, if the number of turns equals 2, the impedance ratio is 4, because 2 squared is 4. If the number of turns equals 3, the impedance ratio is 9, and so on. So whatever the number of turns, you square that number of turns to give you your impedance of that primary or secondary, or your impedance ratio. Okay, that's a given. Okay, that's basic, electrical engineering. When you study that, it's the square of the number of turns. Okay, let me let it drop. W-A-2-C-D-L. I hope I didn't lose anyone at this point. In RF applications, the core material is usually ferrite or powdered iron, because these materials can store and transfer nearly all of the RF energy, and they work well at higher power levels. You know, again, and that's because they don't saturate, like I mentioned before. Dissipating little energy is heat. And if a transformer is saturated, it's going to heat up, and you're going to know that, because you're going to feel the heat coming from it. So you're going to lose power just in heat. That's going to be lost in heat. And I know Dick mentioned that many times as far as power being lost in heat. So because these transformers in RF applications work over a wide frequency range, these are considered broadband transformers. If there is no direct or galvanic connection between the two windings, this could also act as an isolation transformer to block common mode current. So here you go with the common mode, which we've spoken about before. So I know it's a mouthful, I just said, and I could repeat it. They're going into figures. Figure 2 shows a four-winding broadband transformer with impedances, with impedance transformation ratios of 4 to 1, 9 to 1, and 16 to 1. And they show how to build that. And you can make as many ratios as you want. And this is an example of what they call an un-un transformer, which means unbalanced to unbalanced. That's what this is. It's an unbalanced input to unbalanced output. So you have balanced to balanced, you have unbalanced to unbalanced, and you have balanced to unbalanced. Three different types, which you can have used to your depending on your application. So this is an example of an un-un transformer where both the input and output circuits are unbalanced, meaning that they have a common connection to the system's reference voltage. In other words, ground. Everything is common to ground. A transformer can also act as a balance, which transfers power between a balanced feed line or load with both conductors are symmetrical with respect to ground, and an unbalanced system. So, okay.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Okay, W-A-T-C-D-L, and you're listening to Andy's Corner. Okay, I said a mouthful just now, so I'm going to stop here, because now it's 10 to 10, and a little bit to digest, and hopefully some of the people are conveying some of the knowledge that I'm trying to convey to other people. As I said, I'm just reading it, but from experience, I've played around with some of this. But it's been a while, and it has to come back to me, too, because, you know, you don't touch something for a while, you forget it, like simple algebra, which I've taken. So I'm going to give it back to Roy. The next page will be talking about resistive matching, and then we're going to go into reactive matching. And, of course, again, it gets a little bit involved. So we can expand on that as we go ahead. So, any questions up to this point? And if not, then we'll turn it back to Roy, and then we'll be continuing this, because we have a lot to talk about. W-A-2-C-D-L. Okay, no questions here, but I'm sure that there are plenty out there. Roy, back to you. Thank you again. And we, as I said, we'll continue. It gets pretty involved, and it's a good thing to know.
AC2GS, thank you very much, Andy. I appreciate it. I enjoyed Andy's Corner, and I look forward to Andy's Corner again next Sunday night. So thank you very much. It's an intriguing topic. It's a almost overwhelming topic in the importance that impedance has on electronics in general. You know, seldom are we working too hard with DC currents solely in this hobby of ours. They're alternating currents, and under the influence of alternating frequencies, impedance is king. So I thank you for that, Andy.
Okay, I didn't make this up, although I could have. I guess it goes back to Lenz's law and all the other laws that experimenters did way back in the early in the 16th, 15th, 14th, maybe even 13th century. I'm exaggerating, but all right. Talk to you next week. WHCDL.
Okay, I'm looking forward to it. I think Maxwell kind of tied it all up into a bow, and those who kind of cleaned up his equations a little bit better as time went on. So, you know, this is all classic physics, 19th century. Thankfully, it doesn't involve any quantum mechanics or general relativity. So that's always something to be happy with. And if you guys are math nerds, just think in terms that impedance, rather than being a scalar like resistances, it's a tensor. So those who like tensors revel in it, and those who don't know what it is or don't care, don't mind me. Once again, this is AC2GS. Wesley, you wanted to discuss something.
Hey, quick note. There are two devices. One is nano VNA. And I recently, so there are hundreds of videos on it. And there is a new version. The old version was 50 kilohertz to 300 megahertz. And it needs only 5 volts power. So imagine that you have a resonant circuit, any resonant circuit, and or antenna. You don't have a transmitter. You don't have a transceiver. You have nothing. You just have VNA. And you have a piece of wire or whatever it is. Now you can know without connecting it to the rig how it behaves at given frequency of your choice just by connecting VNA. And the new one now, so again the device is nano VNA, N-A-N-O, and then capital VNA. You can see it on YouTube as well. And then they have nano VNA 2.0 version, which goes up to 3.5 gigahertz. And it's starting 20 kilohertz. So the first one was starting from 50 kilohertz. And it does have a touchpad. I mean, the screen is, I believe, not 7 inches. It's smaller, 5 inches. But it's touchpad. Now, the good thing is $60. It is only $60, $55. $48, depends where you buy it. Unbelievable. So it's good to have it. No antenna matching, no antenna analyzer could compete with that, unless somebody has different opinion.
WP2EAD, I have one. You're basically right.
Victor Roy.
Yeah, I agree with Ed. It's a great item. We've discussed it off and on the technical net for a year or two. I've repeatedly mentioned that I was waiting for the new and improved, the broader range nano VNA. Also, in addition, it's a dual port VNA. A lot of times, single port VNAs are more economical. They're cheaper. But this is a dual port, and the screen can come in different sizes. I've seen larger size screens. You have to pay a little bit more of a premium. My understanding is that the circuitry was designed by an engineer in Japan, and then he turned it over to manufacturing in China. And somehow they do wonders as far as keeping the cost down. So, you know, shipped from China, you know, for $40, $50, $60, how can you go wrong? So I was waiting for this one to come out, so I'll be ordering it one of these days. I already have two VNAs, so it's a little bit overkill, but, you know, for $60, $70, how could you go wrong?
Yeah, it's Richard. I have a few professional VNAs. To be honest, I'm worried that I had some in the circuitry. I had some undischarged capacitance that I'm doing something wrong with this thing. Oh boy, I can blow 2-3 of them per week and I will not feel it. So the great thing about it is that if somebody wants to find out what is the beauty to have a VNA, is just to have something that doesn't cost you much, that you don't care that you blow it. And so it's here.
WB2GXM.
Yes, Rich.
AC2GS in the group, WB2GXM. Is there any one source for the nano VNA, it's nano VNA 2, I understand. Is there any one source that would give you the best build, or do you just take your chances with whatever you find?
You have a good answer for that, Wesley. My suggestion would be to go to forum and get a general consensus of people who bought them, played with them, banged them on the table, and kind of given them a good trial before I would seek out their sources. The other idea, which I wouldn't agree with, is just to go to Amazon and go eeny, meeny, miny, moe, or eBay or such. So, again, my suggestion would be hunt down a well-populated forum. Group.io has a very big forum of nano VNA users, and there's more than enough people who tend to point people in the best direction as far as they're aware of a source for these things.
NY2H.
Yeah, Lou.
Yeah, and I think I recall, I don't know if there was ones that were manufactured with a white case and ones with a black case, and ones were notoriously not good to buy and the other ones were excellent to buy. Again, he'll find that in the research. And, you know, that was a while ago, so maybe things have changed. But that was a tell early on the quality.
Yeah, the only problem is in the Chinese market, things change hour by hour. So who knows what that white and black case has mutated into this week. And this is a new design, so it's a new manufacturer, so there's probably more new interesting ways to screw it up. So, again, I would just take it from word of people who've had them, owned them, played with them, have had old ones, and sort of knows the difference between a junk error and a decent manufacturer.
Okay, thank you.
So the device is 2S21, S11. There's two ports on it. It's small, it's touchpad. And for the people who want to recognize version 2, it says 3.5 gigahertz. So that's top limit. I'm not sure about if it's 50 kilohertz down or it's 20 kilohertz, the down limit. So from 20 kilohertz to 3.5 gigahertz, that would be. Actually, you have everything that you need for your antennas. Amazing. And to exist.
Okay, the only proviso I would issue for people listening tonight is that it is not perhaps the best documented piece of equipment, You know, sometimes you buy an expensive piece of equipment and you get a telephone directory that says instruction manual on its cover. You're not going to get anything like that with this. You're going to have to kind of go all over the internet. You're going to have to be a good archivist to figure out sources of documents of how to use it, how to interface your PC with it, and how to get the most out of it. But, you know, if you enjoy doing that, then that could be an added plus. If you just want to take it out of the box, turn it on, and have it do everything, obviously, I think you'll be somewhat disappointed in the short run.
Yeah, I do agree with you. The only thing is that people who never played with it, first they need to have some kind of enjoyment, then disappointment, because they will see discrepancies or inaccuracies or difficulties or just better devices there are on the market. There are three at least ways to describe it. One is new Nano VNA. Another name for it is Nano VNA 2.0. And another name of it is Nano VNA V2. So if you go to the groups, to the forums, you could see what people say about it, how would they differentiate. But definitely the first one that was on the market was V1. So the V1 would be version 1, and this one is version 2. Interesting.
Okay, I mean, that's good to know. I recall them putting all kinds of different letters of the alphabet to designate whether it was a large or a medium-sized one. I've heard them discuss the next generation being designated H. I've heard other people say it was going to be designated X. I guess, like anything, no one really knows until it's out there. So I'm glad to hear it's out there. I can kind of hunt around now and find a good source and get a new toy and plug that into my PC with the thousands of other things that are being plugged in to it and haven't harmed it yet. The other day I started to play around with an AMBI 3000 chip that I had laying around and loaded up a program called the BlueDV. And a very interesting program. It's sort of a hotspot for your computer. You don't need a handy talkie. You don't need any radio equipment at all. It's probably the worst-case scenario for people who think that digital radio is not amateur radio. But I digress.
A few more words about it?
Sure, Wesley.
No, from you. You just mentioned the subject.
Okay. Yeah, it's called BlueDV. It's made from the same gentleman. There is an application that's available for Android and for the IBM PC, you know, what used to be the IBM PC, now just Windows, called BlueDV. The other program is called Peanut. Peanut is a very interesting application for people who want to try out digital radio but don't want to pay even for a relatively inexpensive DMR. You can either load it up on your Android. There is no iPhone app, unfortunately. So if you don't have an Android cell phone, you could use your PC. And it offers you connections to at least 20, 30 different digital networks that you can kind of sample a D-Star network or a Fusion network or a Brandmeister network. So the same guy, before he invented and promoted the Peanut, developed this wonderful little piece of software. If you can supply it with an AMBI voice encoder decoder, it'll handle the rest of the packet manipulation, and you can both receive and transmit on DMR networks, D-Star networks, and Fusion networks just by clicking a button. All you need is a AMBI chip. There are a couple of companies that have packaged AMBI chips that you can plug into your USB port of your computer, and away you go. It's kind of a nice little toy that I just repurposed my AMBI chip for.
There's a DMR that works with D-Star Fusion. And what else?
That's pretty much it. It will. There's a whole bunch of networks that are based on different protocols. So there's an XLX gateway. There's a Yeast.